"Looks all right," Mallory said. "What is the problem?" "Well, I can pump the treadle and I can manage the handles well enough," Disraeli said. "I can get the little needle to move to the letters I want, but nothing comes out." Mallory opened the side of the casing, deftly threaded the perforated tape through its gearing spools, then checked the loading chute for the fanfold paper. Disraeli had failed to engage the sprockets properly. Mallory sat in the office chair, foot-pumped the typer up to speed, and grasped the crank handles. "What shall I write? Dictate something." "Knowledge is power," Disraeli said readily. Mallory cranked the needle back and forth through its glass-dialed alphabet. Perforated tape inched out, winding neatly onto its spring-loaded spool, and the rotating printing wheel made a reassuring popping racket. Mallory let the flywheel die down and ratcheted the first sheet of paper out of its slot. "Knowledge is power," it said. "Takes a dab hand," Mallory said, handing the page to the journalist, "but you'll get used to it." "I could scribble faster than this," Disraeli complained, "and in a better hand by far." "Yes," Mallory said patiently, "but you can't reload the tape. Bit of scissors and glue, you can loop your punch tape through, and the machine spits out page after page, so long as you push the treadle, as many coppers as you like." "Charming," Disraeli said. "And of course you can revise what you've written. Simple matter of clipping and pasting the tape." "Professionals never revise," Disraeli said sourly. "And suppose I want to write something elegant and long-winded, something such as—" Disraeli waved his smouldering pipe. "There are tumults of the mind when, like the great convulsions of nature, all seems anarchy and returning chaos. Yet often, in those moments of vast disturbance, as in the strife of nature itself, some new principle of order or some new impulse of conduct develops itself and controls and regulates and brings to an harmonious consequence passions and elements which seem only to threaten despair and subversion." "That's rather good," Mallory said. "Like it? From your new chapter. But how am I to concentrate on eloquence while I'm pushing and cranking like a washerwoman?" "Well, if you make some mistake, you can always reprint a new page fresh from the tape." "They claimed this device would save me paper."
"You might hire a skilled secretary and dictate."
"They said it would save me money as well,"
Disraeli puffed at the amber tip of his long-stemmed meerschaum.
"I suppose it can't be helped. The publishers will force the innovation on us. Already the Evening Telegraph is setting up entirely with engines. Quite a to-do about it in government. The type-setting brotherhoods, you know. But enough shop talk, Mallory. To work, eh? I'm afraid we must hasten. I should like to take notes for at least two chapters today."
"Why?"
"I'm leaving London for the Continent with a group of friends," Disraeli said. "Switzerland, we think. Some little cantonment high in the Alps where a few jolly scribes can draw a breath of fresh air."
"It is rather bad outside," Mallory said. "Very ominous weather."
"It's the talk of every salon," Disraeli told him, seating himself at his desk.
He began to hunt through cubbyholes for his sheaf of notes.
"London always stinks in summer, but they're calling this the Great Stink. All the gentry have their travels planned or are gone already. There shall scarcely be a fashionable soul left in London. They say Parliament itself will flee upstream to Hampton Court, and the law courts to Oxford."
"What, truly?"
"Oh, yes, dire measures are in the works. All planned sub rosa, of course, to prevent mob panic."
Disraeli turned his chair and winked.
"But measures are coming, you may depend upon that."
"What sort of measures, Dizzy?"
"Rationing water, shutting off smokestacks and gas lights, that sort of thing," Disraeli said airily. "One may say what one likes about the institution of merit lordship, but at least it has guaranteed that the leadership of our country is not stupid."
Disraeli spread his notes across the desk.
"The government have highly scientific contingency plans, you know. Your invasions, your fires, your droughts and plagues."
He leafed through the notes, licking his thumb.
"Some people dote on contemplating disasters."
Mallory found this gossip difficult to believe.
"What exactly is contained in these contingency plans?"
"All sorts of things. Evacuation plans, I suppose."
"Surely you're not implying the government intend to evacuate London?"
Disraeli smiled wickedly.
"If you smelled the Thames outside Parliament, you wouldn't wonder that our Solons want to bolt."
"That bad, eh?"
"The Thames is a putrid, disease-ridden tidal sewer," Disraeli proclaimed. thickened with ingredients from breweries, gasworks, and chemical and mineral factories. Putrid matter hangs like vile seaweed from the pilings of Westminster Bridge, and every passing steamer churns up a feculent eddy that nearly overwhelms her crew with fetor.
Mallory smiled. Wrote an editorial about it, did we?
For the Morning Clarion, Disraeli shrugged. I admit my rhetoric is somewhat over-coloured, but it has been a damned odd summer, and that's the truth. A few days of good soaking rain to flush out the Thames and break these odd, stifling clouds, and all will be well with us. But much more of this freak weather, and those who are elderly or weak of lung may suffer greatly.
You think so truly?
Disraeli lowered his voice. They say the cholera is loose again in Limehouse.
Mallory felt a dreadful chill. Who says it?
Dame Rumour. But who will doubt her in these circumstances? In such a vile summer, it's all too likely that effluvia and fetor will spread a deadly contagion.
Disraeli emptied his pipe and began reloading it from a rubber-sealed humidor stuffed with black Turkish shag.
I dearly love this city, Mallory, but there are times when discretion must outweigh devotion. You have family in Sussex, I know. If I were you, I should leave at once and join them.
But I have a speech to deliver, in 2 days, on the Brontosaurus, with kinotrope accompaniment.
Cancel the speech, Disraeli said, fussing with a repeating match. Postpone it.
I cannot. It is to be a great occasion, a great professional and popular event.
Mallory, there shan't be anyone to see it. No one who matters, anyway. You'll be wasting your breath.
There shall be working men, Mallory said stubbornly. The humbler classes can't afford to leave London.
Oh, Disraeli nodded, puffing smoke. That will be splendid. The sort of fellows who read Tuppenny Dreadfuls. Be sure to commend me to your audience.
Mallory set his jaw stubbornly.
Disraeli sighed. Let's get to work. We've a lot to do. He plucked the latest issue of Family Museum from a shelf. What did you think of last week's episode?
Fine. The best yet.
Too much damned scientific theory in it, Disraeli said. It needs more sentimental interest.
What's wrong with theory, if it is good theory?
No one but a specialist wants to read about the hinging pressures of a reptile's jawbone, Mallory. Truth to tell, there's only one thing people really want to know about dinosaurs. Why the damned things are all dead.
I thought we agreed to save that for the end.
Oh, yes. Makes a fine climax. That business with a great smashing comet and the great black dust storm wiping out all reptilian life and so forth. Very dramatic. Very catastrophic. That's what the public likes about catastrophism, Mallory. Catastrophe feels better than this uniformity drivel about the Earth being 1,000,000,000 years old. Tedious and boring. Boring on the face of it.
An appeal to vulgar emotion is neither here nor there, Mallory said hotly. The evidence supports me. Look at the moon, absolutely covered with comet craters.
Yes, Disraeli said absently. Rigorous science, so much the better.
No one can explain how the sun could burn for even 10,000,000 years. No combustion could last that long. It violates elementary laws of physics.
Give it a rest for a moment. I'm all with your friend Huxley that we should enlighten the public ignorance, but one must throw the dog a bone every once in a while. Our readers want to know about Leviathan Mallory, the man.
Mallory grunted.
That's why we must get back to the business of this Indian girl.
Mallory shook his head. He had been dreading this. She wasn't a girl. She was a native woman.
We've already explained that you've never married, Disraeli said patiently. You won't acknowledge any English sweetheart. The time has come to bring out this Indian maiden. You don't have to be indecent or blunt about matters. Just a few kind words about her, a gallantry or two, a few dropped hints. Women dote on that business, Mallory, and they read far more than men do.
Disraeli picked up his reservoir pen.
You haven't even told me her name.
Mallory sat in a chair.
The Cheyenne don't have names, as we do. Especially not their women. She must have been called something.
Well, sometimes she was called Widow of Red Blanket, and sometimes she was called Mother of Spotted Snake, or Mother of Lame Horse. But I couldn't swear to any of those names, actually. We had this drunken half-breed Frenchie with us as interpreter, and he lied like a cur.
Disraeli was disappointed. You never spoke directly to her, then?
I don't know. I got to where I could manage pretty well with hand signs.
Her name was Waxinihawa, or Waknisiwaha, something much like that.
How would it be if I called her Prairie Maiden? Dizzy, she was a widow. She had 2 grown children. She was missing some teeth and was lean as a wolf.
Disraeli sighed.
You're not cooperating, Mallory.
All right, Mallory tugged his beard. She was a good seamstress, you could say that. We won her, friendship by giving her needles. Steel needles, rather than bison bone splinters. And glass beads, of course. They all want glass beads.
Shy at first, Prairie Flower was won over by her innate love for feminine accomplishments,
Disraeli said, scribbling. Disraeli teased at the edges of the matter, bit by bit, as Mallory squirmed in his chair. It was nothing like the truth. The truth could not be written on civilized paper. Mallory had put the whole squalid business successfully out of his mind, but he had not forgotten it. Not really. As Disraeli sat scribbling his sentimental treacle, the truth surged back at Mallory with savage vividness. It was snowing outside the conical tents, and the Cheyenne were drunk. Whooping, howling, drunken pandemonium, because the wretches had no real idea what liquor was. For them it was a poison and an incubus. They pranced and staggered like bedlamites, firing their rifles into the empty American heavens, and they fell on the frozen ground in the grip of visions, showing nothing but the whites of eyes. Once they had started, they would go on for hours. Mallory had not wanted to go in to the widow. He had fought the temptation for many days, but the time had finally come when he realized it would do his soul less damage to simply get the business over with. So he had drunk 2 inches from one of the whiskey bottles, 2 inches of cheap Birmingham rotgut shipped over with the rifles. He had gone inside the tent, where the widow sat crouched in her blankets and leathers over the dung fire. The 2 children left, their round brown faces squinting bleakly against the wind. Mallory showed her a new needle and did the business with his hands. Lewd gestures. The widow nodded, with the exaggerated wobble of someone to whom a nod was a foreign language, and slid back into her nest of hides, and lay on her back, with her legs spread, and stretched her arms up. Mallory climbed up over her, got under the blankets with her, pulled his taut and aching member out of his trousers, and forced it between her legs. He had thought it would be over with quickly, and perhaps without much shame, but it was too strange and upsetting to him. The rutting went on for a long time, and finally she began to look at him with a kind of querulous shyness, and plucked curiously at the hair of his beard. And at last the warmth, the sweet friction, the rank animal smell of her, thawed something in him, and he spent long and hard, spent inside her, though he had not meant to do that. The 3 other times he went to her later, he withdrew, and did not risk getting the poor creature with child. He was very sorry he had done it even once, but if she was with child when they left, the odds were great that it was not his at all, but one of the other men's. At length Disraeli moved on to other matters, and things became more easy, but Mallory left Disraeli's rooms full of bitter confusion. It was not Disraeli's flowery prose that had stirred up the devil in him, but the savage power of his own memories. The vital animus had returned with a vengeance. He was stiff and restless with lust, and felt out of his own command. He had not had a woman since Canada, and the French girl in Toronto had not seemed wholly clean. He needed a woman, badly. An English woman, some country girl with solid white legs and fat, fair, freckled arms. Mallory made his way back to Fleet Street. Out in the open air, his eyes began to smart almost at once. There was no sign of Fraser in the hustling crowds. The gloom of the day was truly extraordinary. It was scarcely noon, but the dome of St. Paul's was shrouded in filthy mist. Great rolling wads of oily fog hid the spires and the giant bannered adverts of Ludgate Hill. Fleet Street was a high-piled, clattering chaos, all whip-cracking, steam-snorting, shouting. The women on the pavements crouched under soot-stained parasols and walked half-bent, and men and women alike clutched kerchiefs to their eyes and noses. Men and boys lugged family carpet bags and rubber-handled travelling cases, their cheery straw boaters already speckled with detritus. A crowded excursion train chugged past on the spidery elevated track of the London Chatham and Dover, its cloud of cindered exhaust hanging in the sullen air like a banner of filth. Mallory studied the sky. The thready jellyfish mess of rising smoke was gone now, swallowed in a looming opaque fog. Here and there grey flakes of something like snow were settling delicately over Fleet Street, Mallory examined one that lit on his jacket sleeve, a strange slaggy flake of crystallized grit. At his touch it burst into the finest ash. Fraser was shouting at him from beneath a lamppost across the street.
"Dr. Mallory!"
Fraser beckoned in a manner that was, for him, remarkably animated. Mallory realized belatedly that Fraser had likely been shouting at him for some time. Mallory fought and dodged his way across the traffic. Cabs, carts, a large stumbling herd of bleating, wheezing sheep. The effort of it set him gasping. Two strangers stood beneath the lamppost with Fraser, both their faces tightly swathed with white kerchiefs. The taller fellow had been breathing through his kerchief for some time, for the cloth beneath his nose was stained yellow-brown.
"Take 'em off, lads," Fraser commanded.
Sullenly, the two strangers tugged their kerchiefs below their chins.
"The coughing gent," Mallory said, stunned. "Permit me," Fraser said wryly. "This is Mr. J.C. Tate, and this is his partner, Mr. George Velasco. They style themselves confidential agents, or something of the sort."
Fraser's mouth grew thinner, became something almost like a smile.
"I believe you gents have already met Dr. Edward Mallory?"
"We know him,"
Tate said. There was a swollen purple bruise on the side of Tate's jaw. The kerchief had hidden it.
"Bloody lunatic he is. Violent bloody maniac, as ought to be in Bedlam."
"Mr. Tate was an officer on our Metropolitan Force," Fraser said, fixing Tate with a leaden stare. "Till he lost the post."
"I resigned," Tate declared. "I quit on principle, as there's no way to get justice done in the public police in London, and you know that as well as I do, Ebenezer Fraser."
"As for Mr. Velasco, he's one of your would-be dark lantern men," Fraser said mildly. "Father came to London as a Spanish royalist refugee, but our young Mr. George is apt to turn his hand to anything. False passports, keyhole peering, blackjacking prominent savants in the street."
"I'm a native-born British citizen,"
said the swarthy little half-breed, with an ugly glare at Mallory.
"Don't put on airs, Fraser," Tate said. "You walk to beat same as me, and if you're a big brass hat now, it's only so you can sit on dirty scandals for the government. Clap the derbies on us, Fraser. Take us into custody. Do your worst. I've my own friends, you know."
"I won't let Dr. Mallory hit you, Tate. Stop worrying. But do tell us why you've been dogging him."
"Professional confidentiality," Tate protested. "Can't narc on a patron."
"Don't be a fool," Fraser said.
"Your gentleman here is a bloody murderer. Had his rival gutted like a fish."
"I did no such thing," Mallory said. "I'm a Royal Society scholar, not some back-alley conspirator."
Tate and Velasco exchanged glances of amazed scepticism. Velasco began to snicker helplessly.
"What's so amusing?" Mallory said. "They were hired by one of your colleagues," Fraser said. "This is a Royal Society intrigue. Is that not so, Mr. Tate?"
"I told you I ain't telling," Tate said.
"Is it the Commission on Free Trade?" Mallory demanded.
No answer.
"Is it Charles Lyell?"
Tate rolled his smoke-reddened eyes and elbowed Velasco in the ribs.
"He's as pure as the snow, your Dr. Mallory is, just as you say, Fraser."
He wiped his face with his stained kerchief.
"Things have come to a pretty pass, damn it all, with London stinking to perdition, and the country in the hands of learned lunatics with too much money and hearts of stone."
Mallory felt the strong impulse to give the insolent rascal another sharp taste of the fist, but with a swift effort of will he throttled the useless instinct. He stroked his beard with a professorial air and smiled on Tate, coldly and deliberately.
"Whoever your employer may be," Mallory said, "he shan't be very happy that Mr. Fraser and I have found you out."
Tate watched Mallory narrowly, saying nothing. Velasco put his hands in his pockets and looked ready to sidle off at any moment.
"We may have come to blows earlier," Mallory said, "but I pride myself that I can rise above a natural resentment and see our situation objectively. Now that you've lost the cover of deceit under which you have been stalking me, you're of no use to your patron any more. Is that not so?"
"What if it is?" Tate asked.
"The two of you might still be of considerable use to a certain Ned Mallory. What is he paying you, this fancy patron fellow?"
"Have a care, Mallory," Fraser warned.
"If you've watched me at all closely, you must be aware that I'm a generous man," Mallory insisted.
5 shillings a day," Tate muttered.
"Each," Velasco put in, "plus expenses."
"They're lying," Fraser said.
"I'll have 5 golden guineas waiting for you in my rooms at the Palace of Paleontology at the end of this week," Mallory promised. "In exchange for that sum,
I want you to treat your former patron exactly as you've treated me. Simple poetic justice, as it were. Stalk him secretly, wherever he goes, and tell me everything he does. That's what you were hired for, is it not? More or less, Tate admitted. We might think about that, Squire, if you gave us that tin on deposit. I might give you some part of the money, Mallory allowed, but then you must give me information on deposit. Velasco and Tate looked hard at one another. Give us a moment to confer about it. The two private detectives wandered away through the jostle of sidewalk traffic and sought shelter in the leeway of an iron-fenced obelisk.
Those two aren't worth 5 guineas a year, Fraser said.
I suppose they are vicious rascals, Mallory agreed, but it scarcely matters what they are, Fraser. I'm after what they know. Tate returned at length, the kerchief back over his face.
"Cove name of Peter Falk," he said, his voice muffled. "I wouldn't have said that. Wild horses couldn't drag it out of me. Only the bugger puts on airs and orders us about like a bloody lordship. Don't trust our integrity. Don't trust us to act in his interests. Don't seem to think we know how to do our own job."
"To hell with him," Velasco said.
Stuck between kerchief and derby brim, the spit curls on his cheeks stuck out like greased wings.
"Velasco and Tate don't cross the specials for any Peter bloody folk."
Mallory offered Tate a crisp pound note from his book. Tate looked it over, folded it between his fingers with a card sharp as dexterity, and made it vanish.
"Another of those for my friend here to seal the deal."
"I suspected it was folk all along," Mallory said.
"Then here's something you don't know, Squire," Tate said. "We ain't the only ones dogging you. While you hoof along like an elephant, talking to yourself, there's this Flash Cove and his missus on your heels, 3 days in the last 5.
Fraser spoke up sharply.
"But not today, eh?"
Tate chuckled behind his kerchief.
"Reckon they saw you and hooked it, Fraser. That vinegar fizz of yours would make 'em hedge offshore. Jumpy as cats, those two."
"Do they know you saw them?" Fraser said.
"They ain't stupid, Fraser. They're up and flash. He's a racing cove, or I miss my guess, and she's a high flyer. The dolly tried talking velvet to Velasco here, wanted to know who hired us."
Tate paused.
"We didn't say."
"What did they say about themselves?" Fraser said sharply.
"She said she was Francis Radwick's sister," Velasco said, "investigating her brother's murder. Said that straight out without my asking."
"Of course we didn't believe that cakey talk," Tate said. "She don't look a bit like Radwick. Nice looking bit of muslin, though. Sweet face, red hair. More likely she was Radwick's convenient."
"She's a murderess," Mallory said.
"Funny thing, Squire. That's just what she says about you."
"Do you know where to find them?" Fraser asked.
Tate shook his head.
"We could look,"
Velasco offered.
"Why don't you do that while you follow folk?"
Mallory said in a burst of inspiration. "I have a notion they might all be in league somehow."
"Folk's away in Brighton," Tate said. "Couldn't abide the stink. Delicate sensibilities. And if we're to go to Brighton, Velasco and I could do with a railway fare. Expenses, you know."
"Bill me," Mallory said.
He gave Velasco a pound note.
"Dr. Mallory wants that bill fully itemized," Fraser said. "With receipts."
"Right and fly, Squire," Tate said.
He touched the brim of his hat with a copper's salute.
"Delighted to serve the interests of the nation."
"And keep a civil tongue in your head, Tate."
Tate ignored him and leered at Mallory.
"You'll be hearing from us, Squire."
Fraser and Mallory watched them go.
"I reckon you're out £2, Fraser said. "You'll never see those two again."
"Cheap at the price, perhaps," Mallory said.
"No, it ain't, sir. There's far cheaper ways.
At least I shan't be coshed from behind any longer."
"No, sir. Not by them."